From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next Monday, public schools and state offices across Georgia close for Columbus Day. Five states, more than 50 cities, and dozens of universities no longer observe the federal holiday and instead celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. After a unanimous vote this summer, South Fulton became the first city in Georgia on that growing list. Mark Baker is South Fulton's mayor pro tem, and he proposed the solution. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You champion this change. Why celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day?
Well, it's not about an instead of. It's more to amplify the contributions and just acknowledge the fact that there were people here thousands of years before Columbus came. I think that they should be honored, especially in the state of Georgia, given that the national capital for the Cherokee Indians were just in Gordon. I think about 3 miles away from Calhoun County. And I didn't know it was the first, but it's just something that should be done. And nobody had to force my hand to do something that's right.
Well, South Fulton is a new city incorporated in 2016.
Correct.
90% African American. And the first city in Georgia now celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. So in a way, you're planting a flag here. What does this change communicate about the identity of South Fulton?
Well, It definitely identifies us as being progressive to be in this red state of Georgia. I just think that that's the point. The point is we are 90% black. I embrace that concept. I believe that we have an opportunity to govern for ourselves and make our own decisions. And hopefully it becomes infectious.
Well, wondering about infection and being infectious, do you want to draw people to South Fulton because it is a progressive place? Is that part of the goal?
Definitely. I believe that being in the metro Atlanta area, the fifth largest city in the state of Georgia, third largest in the metro Atlanta area, I think it's a refreshing place to be. We're about we're minutes away from the world's busiest airport. We have rail right next to us in Union City and Highway 85 and 285. I mean, it's the best place for business.
This is the mayor making his pitch.
Yeah. Come on. We need the business.
Well, Berkeley, California started the Indigenous Peoples Day in 1990, or first to celebrate, let's say. Some cities do celebrate both, and there has been a lot of opposition from Italian-American groups especially. This is a holiday that did symbolize pride for Italian Americans who had been, experienced a lot of prejudice in the late 19th century, especially. So what do you say to them?
I say nothing to them. I hate to say it like that, but I do say nothing to them. There are approximately 22 million acres stolen from people, you know, who walked the trail of tears with smallpox, you know, in blankets, and they left from Georgia, went all the way to Oklahoma at gunpoint. I mean, by the guy that we spend on a $20 bill every day. So it's not about demonizing Columbus Day. It's not about ostracizing Italians, but it's more like just embracing the chaos that took place and acknowledging it. You know, a lot of those people, you know, at times are nameless and faceless. And if we amplify it, I think we have an opportunity to get the record straight and get history corrected. I mean, 1492, you know, we teach our kids that Columbus discovered America. But the reality of it is he got here and there was a whole lot of people here, you know, and that's miseducation. And we can't afford to have miseducation, especially in South Fulton. Carter G. Woodson said in The Miseducation of the Negro that there's two types of knowledges, one that is given to you and the other that you acquire on your own. And of the two, the latter is the greater. And that's what we want to amplify in South Fulton.
Well, it's one thing to vote on a change. How will the city celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day?
Well, we're a new city, so we had to bring over police, fire, public works, parks and rec, code enforcement. So we're just actually getting our bearings. So this year, we probably can't do as much as we would like, but there will be some celebratory festivities. We're going to get young people involved and try to, you know, just amplify it the best way we can with short notice because it did just happen. We did just pass a budget. We don't have a lot of money yet to, you know, throw at things like this at this time. But, you know, we're looking forward to years and years of celebration.
I did notice on my Apple calendar, you know, on my iPhone that it says Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day on October the 9th.
That's good.
Well, and so communicating the name change is you know, I'm thinking a lot of people are going to catch themselves and say, oh, it's no, it's Indigenous Peoples Day. Is that what you're hoping for?
I'm hoping for that. I definitely am. And I think that the more that happens, the more infectious it is. I know Atlanta has been lobbied for several years, you know, to make this change. But of course, you know, Atlanta's demographic is a little bit different from the city of South Fulton. But, you know, I just think that what's right is right. I've been told by a lot of people who do what I do that I'm turning over chairs and I'm messing up stuff and I need to be careful. But I think that they should have done it some time ago, you know, to the point where when you're doing something right and then you realize that this is the first time that somebody has done it, it's a real eye-opener to just progressive thought in general.
Yeah, I wonder if others are going to follow. Do you expect that?
I do.
Well, Mark Baker, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
South Fulton Mayor Pro Tem Mark Baker, who drafted the resolution that ultimately changed Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day in the city of South Fulton. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think it's time to do away with Columbus Day? Do you think it should be supported and celebrated still? Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Or you can post a comment on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. After 2 years, Pride School Atlanta has shut its doors. The LGBT plus affirming school was the first in the Southeast to serve that community. For founder Christian Zilovitz, Pride School filled a gap that he saw in education. And he joins me now to reflect on the legacy of Pride School Atlanta and tell us what's next. Christian, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So why did Pride School close? What didn't work out?
I would say the large expenses of running a small private school or any size private school, especially an upstart, was probably the biggest thing that bit us in the butt. And so many parents need scholarship funds, and you can only find so many of those out in the community. And payroll taxes are really expensive. The other thing is many of our families came from far away, and having your child travel an hour to an hour and a half each way for school and having to transport them and still try to get to a job is nearly impossible for so many families.
So a lot of heavy lifting there, but let's talk about your motives in creating the school. What was the mission and vision that, what did you want to accomplish in creating this community?
The mission of Pride School Atlanta, which I wrote on the very first day that the idea came to mind, was to create a school that was free of homophobia and transphobia, where everybody had a full seat at the educational table and everybody could be who they were. Just to be, period, learn, period, grow, period.
So what do you hope will be remembered as its greatest accomplishment as trying this?
That's a great question. I would say that every person, especially student who's been involved with our school, is alive today. We have certainly beaten the odds by far, given that the suicide attempt rate and the suicide completion rate is easily 3 to 4 times the amount in your average than your average cisgender kid. For trans youth especially, it's 4 to 5 times higher. And for all the trans youth and trans parents and trans educators who we've worked with, including myself as a trans man, we are all alive. And most of us are doing pretty darn well. And so I would say all the work that everybody did to make this safe space exactly in the time when we needed it, and all the work that we've all done all around the state and all around the world to show LGBT youth that they are affirmed and that they are loved and that they can actually find spaces where people get them and want them to be happy.
Let's hear from one of your students. Josh was born a girl named Sabrina, but identifies as male. Here is Josh talking about what Pride School meant to him as a student.
For me, the Pride School is like, I don't know, like a safe haven, almost. I feel good that I'm open and out and that everyone that I surround myself with is accepting of me.
So what happens next for students like Josh?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you brought up that student who was interviewed on practically the first day of school and was one of our very first students to enroll. Josh actually stopped using that name and male pronouns and went back to using her original name, Sabrina. And many students like Sabrina are out in public schools now. having a pretty good time and spending time in schools where they do get to be themselves. And some of them are off getting their, one student got her GED. One student is in public school where her parents teach over at Redan High School. Some of them are back to homeschooling. And, you know, a lot of it is they have been given, one of the things that we loved about what we gave to Sabrina is that we gave her a chance to reboot and have a place where she didn't have to worry every time she walked into school. And she got grounded again, and she got strong again. And she was able also to give to other students who were facing the same bullying that she faced in Decatur. And now she's set up to be an activist for the rest of her life, should she choose to be, along with all the other kids, because every time they find one other person to talk to, they change the world. And actually, our student number zero, Emerson, who I worked with for almost a year and helped found Pride School, he's off at Marlborough College in Vermont now, and he's found his tribe. And he actually has a trans man roommate and a gay man who's his resident assistant, and he's doing amazing things out in the world. And that's the coolest.
So clearly community was a big part of the goal here. How is that community? Are they staying connected, those who were at Pride School?
Actually, yes. Shockingly to me, some of them who were in school together, they hang out every weekend still. And some of them stayed together for a while. And just like all teenagers, especially the ones who live far away, they connect here and there and they connect here and there. And sometimes they go their separate ways, just like what happens when anybody lives far away. But a lot of the parents have stayed connected with each other. And a lot of the families that didn't even, families who didn't even get to Pride School are probably more connected with each other, including with my family, than some of the families who stayed, you know, who were in the school, because we touched dozens and dozens and dozens of families who were looking for support, who were looking for families like theirs, families for their kids to play with, families for their teens to hang out with, and families to just go and have coffee and not be isolated anymore, because they could actually talk about their kids and not worry about it getting to the whole neighborhood and such.
That is Pride School Atlanta founder Christian Zilovitz. You've called yourself a gender warrior before, Christian. Quickly, before the break, where are you taking your advocacy from here?
Well, the biggest work that I'm doing is supporting LGBT youth wherever they are and supporting LGBTQIA, et cetera, parents and organization, and helping organizations become more LGBT affirming, especially around the gender stuff, because that's the forefront we're at right now. And so we're actually about to do a gender identity training at St. Bart's Episcopal Church over in North Atlanta and over by the Whole Foods. And that'll be a Wednesday night, 3-week session of helping this church, which is really cool, become trans affirming as well.
Christian, thank you.
Thank you.
You can read Pride School's full farewell message. It's posted at gppnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This weekend, the BBC's long-running series Doctor Who makes history when Jodie Whittaker becomes the first woman to assume the title role.
Hold on there, please, madam. I need you to do as I say. This could be a potential crime
scene. Why call me madam?
Because you're a woman.
Am I?
Does it suit me?
Yes. It does, and it has for a long time. Women have played pivotal roles in science fiction for generations. A new anthology digs into that history. Georgia Tech professor Lisa Yazyk is editor of The Future is Female, 25 classic science fiction stories by women. Lisa, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me today, Virginia.
Can you establish for me, is sci-fi okay, or can we say that? No?
We can, yeah. You know, it definitely is not always the words that everyone want to use. You want to be fancy and say, oh, it's science fiction or speculative fiction. But it's a big tent and it appeals to a lot of people. And if sci-fi is what we want to call it, I say let's go for it.
So
it
may be a big tent, but we've seen plenty of women on covers of science fiction books and magazines and comic books and movie posters, yeah, generally looking like fictitious bodies as far as I'm concerned. Right. Why has sci-fi so long been considered as a kind of male space?
Well, I think because it's about science and technology. We think about it as being a genre for boys and their toys. And We tend to associate men with science and technology, and then so with building the future. But, you know, what's so exciting is that everyone wants to be part of the future, and lots of people have gone to science fiction to talk about different kinds of futures.
Well, I learned so much in this book. I'm not a big science fiction reader, although mm-hmm. I've certainly read some, but a number of women authors have had gender-neutral names. Mm-hmm. Others used initials or male pen names. Mm-hmm. We learn in your book that that's not really always just to appeal to male readers, but to protect their identities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first and most important thing to remember, and you'll hear this frequently from contemporary science fiction authors of both of any sex or gender, really, is that you have to protect your name and make sure you don't flood the market. You don't make a ton of money paying writing science fiction. So it is often in your best interest to write a lot of it and to put it out under different names. And one of the things we know, of course, is that both men and women have historically done that. And that women, in particular, when we talk about, oh, they've hidden themselves or they used androgynous names, that was true, but it was rarely because they felt like they had to protect themselves from other men or from readers in the science fiction community. It had to do with larger patterns of culture. So, for instance, Catherine Lucille Moore always went by C.L. Moore, and this was in her, she started her career in the 30s. And for a long time, people thought, oh, she didn't want to be discovered as a woman. But the reality was she was actually protecting her day job at a bank during the Great Depression. And she knew that if her boss knew she had any other line of funding, that she'd probably lose that job.
And similarly, Alice Sheldon, who became James Tiptree Jr.
Yeah.
What was she protecting?
Well, she was one of the first CIA agents in America. So I think she just had spook behavior ingrained into her. And she was just protecting her true identity. But also, more importantly, she had just received a PhD in psychology and was launching an academic career. And so she was really protecting that career as much as anything else.
One of the foundational texts for the genre of science fiction altogether is Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's Frankenstein. And we cannot resist hearing from one of its many adaptations, Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Well, your book gets to another assumption that there were no great women science fiction authors after Shelley until the feminist writers of the 1970s. And those who did write were writing like men, you know, about boys and their toys, the veneration of technology. Right. You consider their role a lot more transformational. How?
Yeah, well, first of all, there were actually quite a few women in the science fiction community. Women have always been a significant and vocal minority from the 1920s, when the first magazines were established, until the revival of feminism in the 1960s. Women accounted for about 15% of all contributors to the science fiction community. And interestingly, that maps pretty well to the numbers of women in science and engineering. And then after the 70s, those numbers double in both sets of fields. So that's interesting. But yeah, women were there from the beginning, and they certainly wrote about all the same kinds of things that men did. Sleek spaceships, the mechanics of space travel, exotic aliens, fantastic planets. But they also thought a lot about the impact of science and technology on us on Earth, and especially in the home. If you think about it, it's really one of the first places where we do meet advanced sciences and technologies is in our everyday life in the home. We engage with everything from, you know, plumbing, which we don't think about, but we shouldn't take for granted, to our media devices, right, to microwaves. And so women thought about that, like, how do these transformations in the home affect us and as wives, as mothers, as lovers, as children? And then also, what is it that women can do to go out and change the future in the public sphere?
Well, female science fiction authors also wrote about politics, the evolution of women's health. Yeah. I'm thinking of stories like Margaret Atwood's novel, The Handmaid's Tale, which, you know, was not a short story, so it's not in this book. But it imagined a future where women are relegated to vehicles for human reproduction and survival is under attack. This has been adapted into a hit TV show.
Yep. You girls will serve the leaders of the faithful and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
Oh, you are so lucky!
So, Lisa, how did the freedom of science fiction, did that allow women to discuss issues like reproductive rights and sexual agency? I mean, these are topics that didn't usually exist in public spaces, especially for women.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, as long as you're telling a story about, like, the blue aliens oppressing the yellow aliens on planet Z, right, then that's not about Earth. So absolutely, it gives you a lot of freedom to explore issues that can be difficult to talk about in the here and now. So For instance, women were real leaders in the anti-nuclear war movement in the 50s, and they were leaders in creating that kind of science fiction as well. Women used this to talk about the first battle of the sexes stories, to think about the relations between men and women in the public sphere. So one of the stories that I talk about is Leslie Stone's The Conquest of Gola. That's in the anthology. It's a story from the early 1930s, and it's one of the first battles of the sexes stories. And how could it be more timely, 10 years after the suffrage movement had succeeded and gotten women the vote?
And also one of the first narrated by a woman.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the first stories also where aliens win against humans. So a lot of firsts in that particular story.
I'm speaking with Georgia Tech Science Fiction Studies Professor Lisa Yazyk. Just ahead, we're going to discuss how female science fiction writers help inspire women in STEM fields today. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we were talking about the formative role women authors have had in science fiction, among them Alice Sheldon. Her novella, Houston, Houston, Do You Read?, was adapted by NPR in the 90s as an audio drama.
And then I started watching, looking for the patterns, something missing, something wrong.
Sheldon and other prolific female sci-fi writers are featured in a new anthology by Georgia Tech professor Lisa Yazyk. It's called The Future is Female. So it's funny thinking about, I was reading something about a woman who was asked to write a science fiction book about women. And she said, what do you want? Bridget Jones meets the Matrix, you know, robots who want to talk about their feelings. So is there a way that even presenting accomplished women writers, there's this kind of bent towards you must be doing genre fiction, you must be doing something for women only?
That's so interesting. And to a certain extent, I can see that, because historically, that was one of the ways that women made room for themselves in science fiction, was to call attention to the fact that women operated in the present and would likely be in the future as more than just love interests or damsels in distresses or even alien queens, that they might occupy all kinds of roles as scientists, as pioneers, even as high-tech housewives.
Well, in fact, you quote in the book, Lee Brackett, she wrote in 1944, readers are tired of the yarn based on the superhero and the ravishing babe. So they were offering something different.
Absolutely.
So how did that grow the genre?
Well, it helped allow women, it provided women with more of a voice. There have always been women in science fiction, but it really gave a lot of women something to talk about with each other and with other fans in the community. Another thing that women's science fiction really did was it pushed character development in science fiction, and that was actually really huge in terms of getting mainstream recognition for the genre. The genre had long been about big ideas, and people really celebrated that. And characters were often, especially in the first decades, pretty flat. They were vehicles for conveying those ideas. But as Brackett noted, you can only do so much if you're just relying on really basic stereotypes, and the stories get boring pretty quickly. Science fiction author or fans, they pride themselves on being smart. They want to be challenged. And so I think when you bring to them stories about housewives who are worried about the impact of nuclear weapons on the nuclear family, or even depictions of human men who really struggle with their feelings about the alien other, that it provides us with a way to connect with these stories at a human level and at a sort of emotional level as well as an intellectual one.
Well, among the 25 authors in your book, Octavia Butler and a contemporary author, N.K. Jemisin, whose Broken Earth trilogy has won the Hugo Award for Best Novel for the past 3 years. Right. Here she is at the awards earlier this year.
I have gritted my teeth while an established professional writer went on a 10-minute tirade at me for mentioning underrepresentation in the sciences. I've kept writing even though my first novel, The Killing Moon, was initially rejected on the assumption that only black people would ever possibly want to read the work of a black writer.
So she's talking about discrimination she felt as a woman of color in the genre. How have female science fiction writers of color helped expand these ideas of race and class through their work?
I think that black women writers have been particularly good at drawing our attention to intersectionality and the complicated ways, not just that the future is female, but that it might also be of color and queer and disabled and poor as well as wealthy. And, you know, William Gibson, he's a pretty famous contemporary science fiction writer, once said, it's not that the future isn't here, it's just that it's distributed unequally. And I feel like authors like Jemisin and Butler remind us about the promise and perils of those unequal distributions.
You mentioned earlier about how few women, or what a small percentage of women there are in technology fields. Mm-hmm. And so the things that, the design of technology that we use every day, mm-hmm. the infrastructure, the information, not necessarily represented by women, mm-hmm. and that reading science fiction writers can inspire women in the sciences. I'm wondering if you've encountered that as a professor, as a teacher.
I have. So, of course, there's the big famous examples. And the two big famous examples are astronauts Pamela Melroy and Mae Jemison, local Georgia woman, in fact. So that's wonderful. But they've both spoken very passionately about how authors, including Anne McCaffrey and Octavia Butler, really inspired their career. And I think it was Melroy who, when she went to the International Space Station, actually took copies of Anne McCaffrey's novels, and she would take photos and send them back. But I have had that. In fact, just last week, I had a wonderful example of what we're talking about, the way these stories can move not just the famous people we know through the media, but people in our everyday lives. So I was having a meal with one of my research assistants. I actually had an undergraduate research team who helped gather biographical information for this book. And one of the people I was working with, she's a bioengineering major at Georgia Tech and minoring in science fiction, and so she had been doing this research with me, and she's getting ready to graduate. So we were talking about her future plans, and she was very excited. She said, "I finally figured out what I want to do." And she's like, "I really want to go work in new reproductive technologies, because so much of reproduction is still based on male models, and we don't really think about using women as the fit models for their own reproductive technologies. And I want to work on this, and I want to think about ways to make it cheap and free and easy to distribute across the world." And she got really excited, and then she stopped and looked at me and said, "You know, the reason I've decided to do this is because after all that research I did with you and reading all these stories by women and reading the stories of these women's lives, it really occurred to me that no one is going to change the future if women don't do it for themselves."
Wow.
So the future really was female for 5 minutes at my coffee table, and it was amazing.
And how about now, as you look at the future, all of the world building that has been done in fiction by these women, how does it help us imagine the world differently?
I think it shows it that there are different possibilities, right? That women have not always had a voice in the future, and we don't necessarily always agree with the futures that are offered to us. And this is true, of course, for all kinds of people, people of color, queer people, even straight white men don't necessarily agree with the futures that we receive through the mainstream media. So it's exciting to see science fiction open this up, and that we're living in a moment where, especially with digital technologies, lots of people can get their visions out and really show us lots of different ways the future might be.
Lisa Jacek, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Lisa Jacek is a Georgia Tech professor and editor of the anthology The Future is Female, 25 Classic Science Fiction Stories by Women.